From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Bank vaults and prison gates could swing open in the year 2000. Today, a conversation with the man who invented the computer escape key. He also warned Richard Nixon and the Pentagon about how to escape the Y2K problem 30 years ago. Obviously, they didn't listen. Also, the U.S. blocks international efforts to ban the use of child soldiers. This is President Clinton speaks out against child labor. And the latest from Kosovo in our daily War and Peace report. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is on the front page of the Washington Post today, with ethnic Albanian guerrillas establishing offices, erecting checkpoints, and occupying police stations in Kosovo as Yugoslav forces have withdrawn. NATO commanders move for the first time today to rein in the newly empowered rebels and allay concerns among Serbian civilians about possible reprisal attacks. In the first major confrontation between Kosovo Liberation Army rebels and allied forces, U.S. Marines yesterday stripped weapons from about 200 guerrillas in the Kosovo village of Zegra. The action followed a tense standoff in which the KLA members refused at first to surrender their weapons, then complied when the Marines used armored personnel carriers and Cobra helicopter gunships to intimidate them. The Marines then led away six rebel leaders in handcuffs. The Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal will send its first team of investigators to Kosovo tomorrow and begin gathering evidence of widespread atrocities in the province, this according to a Hague spokesperson. Chief Prosecutor Louise Arbour believes there will be enough evidence within Kosovo's borders to issue more indictments against suspected war criminals. The UN court could send as many as 300 experts to the region in coming weeks to ensure that it gathers all the evidence it needs before winter sets in. Louise Arbour has been asked about whether NATO and U.S. officials will be considered for indictments for war crimes. She says she doesn't comment on ongoing investigations. This news from Beijing: a U.S. envoy failed to convince Chinese officials that NATO bombed China's embassy in Yugoslavia by mistake, ending a mission to Beijing with relations still in disrepair. China said it's impossible that the United States did not know the location of the embassy in Belgrade. It rejected Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering's explanation of the attack as unconvincing and repeated calls for severe punishment of those responsible. The Chinese rejection dashed hopes that Pickering's visit would reverse the damage to U.S.-China relations caused by the May 7th bombing. China offered no sign of today it was ready to resume military relations and other contacts with Washington, including talks on China's entry into the World Trade Organization that Beijing suspended in anger over the attack. Instead, Beijing added a new demand that the United States pay prompt and adequate compensation for the deaths of three Chinese reporters, injuries to 20 others, and property damage. A B-2 bomber hit the embassy with five 2,000-pound satellite-guided bombs. Setting aside policy differences over Kosovo, Iraq, and other contentious issues, the United States and Russia concluded an agreement in Washington yesterday extending for 7 years programs to reduce the threat posed by nuclear, biological, chemical, and other weapons of mass destruction. The Cooperative Threat Reduction Program has spent $2.7 billion between 92 and 99, helping Russia, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Belarus, Uzbekistan, and other members of the former Soviet Union reduce, control, and eliminate unconventional weapons in their military inventories. The bulk of these funds, about $1.7 billion, has been spent on projects in Russia. A senior Pentagon official said at least that much will be spent over the next 7 years. Republican from Oklahoma, Senator James Inhofe, was criticized yesterday at a news conference by the Human Rights Campaign, which is the nation's largest gay and lesbian political organization, as well as Oklahoma activists, for hiding behind privacy concerns and obfuscating on the details surrounding the recent pornography scandal that has enveloped his office. The sudden concern for privacy is highly suspect, considering his personal attacks on James Hormel during his bid to become ambassador to Luxembourg, this according to the Human Rights Campaign. The communications director, David Smith, said Senator Inhofe's staff should have used their highly honed internet skills to download the Constitution instead of pornography. He went on to say if they would have downloaded the Constitution, they would have seen that the framers never saw the process as a means in which to derail qualified nominees based on prejudice. Furthermore, he said, they would have learned that there isn't a constitutional right to place a hold on nominations. Large quantities of pornography were discovered to have been downloaded onto several taxpayer-funded staff computers in Inhofe's office. The pictures were found during a routine systems check, according to the Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call. The newspaper reported there was such a voluminous collection of lewd material that it messed up the senator's computer system. The senators behind the attack on the openly gay philanthropist James Hormel, who was appointed by Clinton in a recess appointment as ambassador to Luxembourg. You invite me to a war party. Me no wanna go. Everybody seem to be inviting me to a war party. Me no wanna go. Heard about the last one, so thanks, but no thank you. Yo-ho. You killed off all the Indians and you killed off all the slaves, but not quite so you kill off the remains. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said today NATO will not give in to demands from Russia for its own zone in the Kosovo mission. Speaking before a meeting with her Russian counterpart, Igor Ivanov, Albright said talks continue on reaching a solution to the issue, which has become a sticking point between NATO and Russia. President Boris Yeltsin insisted today that Russia won't back down over its demand that Russian peacekeeping troops in Kosovo control their own sector in the province. Meanwhile, Russia said today that NATO forces are being too complacent about the demilitarization of the Kosovo Liberation Army and asked the Security Council to discuss the issue. U.S. Marines had some tense moments in their first confrontation with rebels. The Marines said 117 fighters refused to give up their weapons yesterday near Vladvo in southeastern Kosovo, and NATO had to threaten force, including Cobra attack helicopters, before the rebels gave in. We go now to Kosovo, where Jeremy Scahill, Pacifica reporter, is standing by. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
So can you tell us what Pristina, as well as the other cities like Prizren, what is happening there now?
Well, actually, Amy, I'm standing right now in a convoy of Gypsy and Roma people that are actually fleeing Kosovo right now. And there's a saying here that when the Gypsies leave, you know it's bad. They have historically been the last people to flee their homes. But you do see a large convoy of Gypsy and Roma people, many of them traveling by foot. They don't have cars, or they're traveling by horse-drawn carriages, leaving the country. And they say that they're going because they fear increased fighting between the KLA as well as the remaining Serb forces. Now, those being widely reported, Serbian police army are pulling out. There are serious questions about the paramilitaries that are backed by Belgrade here. I've talked to several soldiers there to whisper off.
Jeremy, you are cutting in and out.
I'll try to move over, sorry. But the paramilitaries, several of them have said to us that they are disillusioned by the agreement that Belgrade signed with NATO in Macedonia a while ago. They say they didn't come down here for 2 months to fight, to have their brothers die in their arms, just to leave then. And so it seems as though the paramilitaries will remain a presence, which raises the specter of having two separate death squads operating simultaneously, one being backed by Belgrade, the other being protected by NATO, that being the Kosovo Liberation Army. The KLA has massively increased its public presence throughout Kosovo. They now have taken over schoolhouses and police stations. You see them openly operating armed checkpoints along the road, sometimes in full view of NATO forces. They have attacked Serbian civilians. In fact, they burnt down a monastery outside of Prizren this week. So many, many people are afraid that the fighting is not going to decrease, but rather increase as the KLA fortifies its position under NATO protection and as some Serb paramilitary forces remain on the ground here.
Have you gotten a chance to speak with Serb military and or paramilitary forces?
I have, Amy, and when you talk to them, they many of them say that they don't want to leave. They're very disillusioned by the agreement. They feel that Yugoslavia has lost Kosovo. Increasingly, you see Albanians out on the street who say that it's the first time in months that they've been able to come out of hiding. You also see a stream of people coming in from Macedonia and Albania, and I think that this outrages the remaining forces here, and so some of them have said that they are going to stay. NATO may have heavy weapons, but we know the terrain here, and so that could raise the specter of serious fighting continuing for weeks and weeks to come. Now, all of this comes...
Jeremy, let me ask if you have had a chance to talk with Serb soldiers or paramilitary, what they've said about what has happened there over the past months.
Well, widely when you talk to Serbian people in Belgrade and even in Kosovo, they say that they could imagine the paramilitary forces carrying out systematic rapings or the burning and looting of houses or shooting of Albanian civilians, but they tend to deny that they believe that the Yugoslav army could be involved with this. But actually, the other night I had a conversation with two Yugoslav army soldiers, and they told us that, in fact, members of their platoon had, in fact, carried out rapes against Albanian women and had, in fact, attacked Serbian civilians. Now, I'm in the north of Kosovo right now, and when we were driving along the road, we passed a neighborhood of ethnic Albanians. The homes were completely torched and burnt down, and graffiti was on the walls. And what that graffiti said was, "Only unity saves the Serbs." It's a symbol that you see extensively throughout the country. Serbian people that remain in Kosovo are considering seriously fleeing. Already tens of thousands of them have fled. And today, it's interesting, Amy, we got word that the Patriarch of the Orthodox Church called for President Slobodan Milosevic to resign. This is an extraordinary move. The church has historically stayed out of politics. It has said that it stands with the people and does not involve itself. But this week, the church did officially call for Slobodan Milosevic to step. And part of the reason for that is that the Metohija region of Kosovo is considered a holy land for people here. Well, these Serbs are fleeing the area, and the church is extraordinarily concerned about this. They have asked and begged their people to stay, but that is not happening. Serbs are pulling out, fearing increased attacks by the KLA. Yes, in fact, the KLA had a standoff with Marines, but that is something that you see very rarely around here. Oftentimes, you see a full view of NATO forces standing out in the streets or operating these checkpoints. It very much gives the appearance that NATO is on the side very much of the KLA, and I think the Serbian population fears the fact that its forces are now pulling out.
Jeremy, Sir Michael Jackson, who heads the NATO forces, was speaking to Serb civilians through a loudspeaker in Pristina yesterday, urging them not to leave, saying, "We will protect you." It's a little bit hard to imagine, considering it's the same forces, I'm sure from the Serb point of view, that bombed them, and it's hard to believe. But Pristina, unlike the area that I had just read about in the Kosovo village of Zegra, where the KLA and NATO clashed, is an area where the KLA is out in full view. Is that right?
Absolutely. And what has happened, and this is the pattern we're seeing extensively, not just in Pristina, but elsewhere as well, that the KLA has been able to fortify its presence under a sort of NATO protection. Now, the question is whether or not it's an intentional move on the part of NATO. I think a lot of Serbian civilians here tend to think that
we didn't hear what you just said, Jeremy.
I was saying that the KLA has been able to fortify its position, not just in Pristina, but elsewhere. And the serious question that arises is whether or not this is with a full conscious mindset of NATO. Serbian civilians tend to believe that the KLA has come in and strengthened itself with the direct compliance of NATO. Now, I visited several KLA headquarters in the Pristina area, and twice when I was visiting those headquarters, NATO representatives showed up to establish a liaison with the KLA. Consistently, foot soldiers tell me that they are not disarming the KLA. They're merely asking them not to display their weapons in public. So there are large caches of weapons throughout Pristina and other cities held by the KLA.
Jeremy, I hope you could stay on with us for a few minutes. We are also joined on the phone by a doctor who has been investigating human rights abuses against Kosovar Albanians that she and others have gotten a chance to talk to over the last few months. She's Jennifer Leaning, a professor of medicine at Harvard School of Public Health, and she's a member of the group Physicians for Human Rights, which this week held a news conference in Washington, releasing a report where allegations of human rights abuses were compiled, having interviewed something like 1,200 refugees expelled this spring from all parts of Kosovo. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dr. Leaning.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what you found?
We found that the experience of the refugees who had fled from all parts of Kosovo to Macedonia and Albania between late March and early May was one of flight before terror of the Serbian forces. Two-thirds of them said they fled because of the Serbian forces. None of them fled because of fear of NATO bombing. And there was a very high level of beating, torching of homes, looting of houses, stealing and extraction of identity cards, small incidents of rape, which, you know, has a number of interpretations in terms of our study, and some witnessing of murders, 59 independent instances of witnessing people having being killed in front of people's eyes or immediately seeing their dead bodies was verified by this survey. It was it's a very careful study, which it involves a statistical sampling of refugee camps on both borders, that is, Albania and Macedonia, and has a number of limitations that I think would all tend to underestimate the level of atrocity within Kosovo, one being that much of the allegations of mass killings seem to surface, and of actually mass rape, seem to surface from refugees who are fleeing the last 3 or 4 weeks from early May until the end of May. And that population was not captured by our study. But our study shows a very diffuse, systematic, and pervasive campaign by the Serbian forces, military units as well as paramilitary, with some complicity by Serb civilians against the widespread population in Kosovo.
You mentioned a small number of rapes and said that you have different interpretations of that. What are your interpretations?
One is method. This survey was done in camps where, you know, people are clustered in tents, and it's very difficult to get people to talk to you by themselves. So there were usually other people in the tent when we were talking to women. And it's known that there's a great social stigma against rape. That's true in virtually every culture. It's a very complex one and very forbidding one for ethnic Albanian women. To be raped is bring shame on you, but also on your entire family. So getting people to acknowledge this is difficult. Secondly, we think that there's a likelihood that rape may have been more evident in people who stayed and were caught than in people who fled. So many of the people that we were interviewing had already been in the camps for 2 to 3 weeks. And so they fled within 2 to 3 weeks of the war. And so there was a very brief window for many of these episodes to have taken place. And in the early phases of the Serbian accelerated attack on this population, rape may not have been as big an instrument of terror and oppression as it became in the later phase of the war.
I wanted to ask Jeremy something about a report of a massacre that took place and then get your response to it, Dr. Leaning, about how massacres can be confirmed and about the circumstances around them. And this is about the mass grave that has been found at Kachanak. And Jeremy, you were there earlier this week. There was a front page Washington Post piece on it, the belief that dozens of ethnic Albanians are buried there. What have you heard about it in Kosovo?
Well, I actually talked to two young men from the southern Kosovo village of Irosovac who say they know who buried the people that are buried there. And the people that buried them, allegedly, according to these two men, are two Serbs and a gypsy. And the way that they say it happens, and I should preface this by saying that this is people who told me they know the people who did it, and they're relaying to me this story. So having said that, what they say happens is that there was fighting between the KLA and the Yugoslav army. The KLA killed six Yugoslav army soldiers. The army called in backup. The backup came in and shot and killed all of the KLA people who were involved in the fighting between the KLA and the Yugoslav army. They say then that the civic authorities, who were the two Serbs and the gypsy, then went in to bury these people. And so what they're saying is that when they dig that up, what they will find is 50 bodies. 48 of them will be men, 2 of them will be women, and they will all be wearing KLA camouflage uniform. Now, this is people who say that they know the people who worked for the civic authority and actually did those burials. And they said that you'll also find 6 Yugoslav army soldiers buried in an Orthodox cemetery outside of Arosavac on the same day.
Well, I wanted to get the response of Dr. Leaning after stations identify themselves and we break. But how you go about collecting data on what happens after atrocities take place. We're talking to Jeremy Scahill in Kosovo and Dr. Jennifer Leaning of Physicians for Human Rights. She's in Boston. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
But not quite so you kill off the remains. You look for me, I'm looking for you. I can't believe what they say about you is true. That you're a bastard just like Pharaoh. You kill the children just like Pharaoh. Now you send a ticket for me. You don't have RSVP. Oh Lord, it's a war party.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, our daily war and peace report. I'm Amy Goodman. Jeremy Scahill joins us from Kosovo, and Dr. Jennifer Leaning of the Harvard School of Public Health and Physicians for Human Rights is with us in Boston. They just released a major report this week that is based on interviews with some 1,200 ethnic Albanian refugees that have been expelled this spring from all parts of Kosovo. Dr. Leaning, what is your response to a story like that?
I would say it's possible. There are, in today's New York Times, stories from various reporters all over Kosovo that suggest they're being led to 20 to 30 mass grave sites with various stories associated with them. I think this is going to require an enormously careful and deliberate approach on the part of the War Crimes Tribunal and its 300-plus staff who are going to have a major task in excavating these graves and trying to piece together the story. The very crucial part of this is to cordon off the grave sites so that they cannot be further tampered with. One concern we have is that there are already stories of the ways in which the Serbian forces have redug up graves, have tried to conceal what they did. There's been one story I heard of the major mine, which has huge ovens and mine shafts, where there were allegations of burning of bodies. That mine, the Trepča mine, in the area of Mitrovica, has been dismantled and the ovens carried off to Serbia. So there will be some tampering of evidence. And so it's essential that NATO cordon them off, as they're starting to do. Photographs need to be taken of the undisturbed site, and photos at various series of the excavations. One needs forensic pathologists and human rights investigators and lawyers on site during all excavation processes. You've got to compile identifiers linked to bodies, specific effects, you know, shoes and clothing and jewelry. One needs to be very clear about specific aspects of the body, that is, did the person have a artificial leg, et cetera. DNA samples will need to be taken of the bodies.
And is it a war crime if people who are killed are soldiers?
No. It partly depends upon, I should back up, it partly depends under what circumstances they're killed. If they have surrendered and then they are killed, it is a violation of the Geneva Conventions and a war crime. If they are killed in the course of active combat, that is one of the costs and sorrows of war that is considered legitimate. So the circumstances of their death would be very important. Just finding that the people who were buried are KLA soldiers is not sufficient to absolve the Serbs of responsibility.
Uh-huh. And finally, this whole issue of who gets charged with war crimes, that is usually the vanquished, and even if victors commit war crimes, they're not going to be charged. Jamie Shea, the NATO spokesperson in May, said, of course, they're not going to be looking at us, the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. We pay for the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. But what about this issue? Louise Arbour has been asked about it a few times, whether NATO and U.S. Will be looked at in terms of crimes committed against humanity and the bombing of civilians. What are your thoughts on that?
It probably will continue to be raised as an issue. As you know, there's already been one finding when the Serbian government brought this. The court rejected the jurisdiction and said that it was not something they wanted to deal with at this moment. I think that the overall scale of what has happened would suggest that it's important for the world to pay attention to charge the Serbian government with grotesque violation of human rights and massive war crimes. The deaths of civilians that occurred in the course of the NATO bombing need to be examined. But in general, bombing always creates casualties. And given the number of sorties and the extent to which this countryside, both Kosovo and Serbia, the extent to which it was bombed, the number of civilian casualties is relatively low.
Jeremy Scahill, in Kosovo, the people who, the ones that you spoke to, said that buried these bodies, will they come forward to tell what happened?
No, they won't. And the reason I actually tried very, very hard to get to talk to them, and I got as far as the village, but then I wasn't able to talk to them. And their fear is that even though they were doing their job as part of civil authorities, they fear being prosecuted by a war crimes court because they know it has been determined to be a quote-unquote mass grave. And so even if they were to come forward, and it was, in fact, the battle that they described, and then they just consequently buried members of the KLA, they still fear, because of the lopsidedness of the entire operation, the extraordinary bias against the Serbian side, that they would be prosecuted even though they were doing their job as civil servants. Now, I do want to mention one thing, and that is that many of these graves that they're finding, the NATO forces are being led there by members of the KLA, and so that just should be put out there and stated. The other is that I have talked extensively with Albanians in several villages, some of whom had fled to Macedonia and now are returning, and some who have remained through the entire bombing campaign. And what they say, and they describe a systematic increase in the attacks after NATO's bombing began. They say that the attacks were very, very terrible prior to NATO's bombing, but that they got exponentially worse after the bombing began. They felt that there was an increased and very intense rage on the part of the forces that were attacking Albanians because of the bombing. They were holding the Albanians accountable for the fact that the bombing was so intense, not just in Kosovo, but throughout the country. And I think to say that there have been a relatively low number of casualties in this war is to cast aside that the value of human life. Thousands and thousands of people have been killed by this bombing. The environment in Kosovo is entirely polluted from the use of massive amounts of bombs. People will continue to suffer for years to come. This was in clear violation of international law and violation of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. People here know that, and they continue to be outraged even though the bombs have stopped falling. Both Kosovar Albanians and Serbs and Gypsies and all of the other ethnic groups here continue to be outraged at what this bombing has done.
Dr. Laning?
Yes. There is no question that there was an acceleration in the war and that there was an acceleration in Serbian atrocities as a result of the NATO bombing. No question. But I have been in that area four times in the last year and witnessed it in June, in November, and in March for 3 weeks before the bombing started, and then was there in April and early May in the camps. It is absolutely clear that the Serbian forces were intending to ethnically cleanse Kosovo from the beginning of this war in March of 1998. And it was a grotesque, chilling, and miserable existence for Kosovar Albanians throughout this last year as the Serbian forces were killing and burning villages. It is an acceleration that has happened since the NATO bombing. In our view, it was essential that there be an intervention to put a stop to the campaign of ethnic cleansing. I am not saying that the loss of life that has occurred and the loss of society that has occurred in the last 3 months is something that anyone can look at with calm or resignation. It is a terrible tragedy, and it's a tragedy for Serbia as well as for Kosovo. But I think this attempt to equate NATO actions with the actions of the Serbian government is a striking loss of perspective on what constitutes war crimes, what constitutes agency, and what constitutes evil. And I will resist the attempt to make equal the depredations of the Serbian forces and the response of the NATO forces.
Dr. Leening, a few days ago, we had Walter Rockler on our show, who is a Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal prosecutor. And he'd written an op-ed piece in the Chicago Tribune saying that NATO was guilty of war crimes when you look at the intense bombing of the civilian infrastructure. What are your thoughts about that?
We wrote a letter to President Clinton in the midst of the NATO bombing, saying that it was very important to look at the rules of engagement that he was and that NATO forces were, that he was requiring NATO forces to follow through the support of General Clark's instructions, which meant bombing from 15,000 feet created a situation where the military losses would be relatively light on the NATO side because they were out of range of the anti-aircraft guns, but meant that despite all precision attempts, civilian casualties on the ground would be increased because it was impossible to be as sure as you could be if you're flying at 5,000 feet or 2,500 feet. And it is a violation of the rules of war to have your strategy be such that you minimize military casualties and that the fallout of that is an increase in civilian casualties. And I think that is the one parameter that needs to be examined very closely and, in my view, would constitute a very interesting grounds on which to have a countercharge placed against NATO in a war crimes trial. I am not saying that it would be an incorrect thing to raise a war crimes charge against NATO. I am saying that in war there are always horrible atrocities on both sides. But in this situation, there is a preponderance of evidence that would say the Serbian government and the Serbian forces need to be brought before a most thorough and exacting examination.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. We have a lot more guests and information to deal with in this show. Dr. Jennifer Leening from Physicians for Human Rights and professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Can you tell us where people can go on the web or where people can call to get the report that PHR put out?
The website for Physicians for Human Rights is www.phrusa.org.
That's www.phrusa.org.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us from Boston. And Jeremy, thank you for being with us from Kosovo. And take care. Jeremy Scahill reporting from Kosovo. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on with our show today, the International Labor Organization, known as the ILO, has just adopted a treaty banning the worst forms of child labor, including slavery and trafficking. The pact was approved by ILO's 174 member states, as well as workers' and employers' representatives at the UN agency's annual meeting in Geneva. The convention, which aims to protect those under 18, targets child slavery, forced labor, trafficking, debt bondage, serfdom, prostitution, pornography, and exploitative work in industries using dangerous machinery and hazardous substances. President Clinton backed the treaty in a speech to the ILO yesterday. But according to human rights organizations, the U.S. has been obstructing a broad prohibition on the use of child soldiers in the agreement, weakening some of its provisions to suit its own domestic practices. We're joined now by Joe Becker, who is the Children's Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joe. Joe, are you with us?
I am.
Can you talk about what the U.S. position is on child soldiers?
Sure. Increasingly, the use of child soldiers is being recognized as a child labor issue. We estimate that there are about 300,000 children under the age of 18 that are currently participating in armed conflicts around the world. clearly they face extreme hazards and risk to health and safety. They sustain far higher casualty rates than their adult counterparts and often suffer serious psychological damage from their experiences. There was a move at the International Labor Conference to include a very broad prohibition on the participation of children in armed conflict in the new convention. But we were very disappointed that the U.S. launched a massive lobbying campaign to block this proposal. The reason is because the United States is one of a minority of countries that still recruits minors into its armed forces. We actually have fewer than 7,000 17-year-olds in our active duty force. And since our military numbers 1.5 million, that actually represents less than 0.5% of our forces. But the Pentagon refuses to guarantee that that small number of 17-year-olds won't be sent into combat. So if this convention had totally banned the use of children in armed conflict, that means the U.S. would have been in violation, since international labor law defines a child as anyone under the age of 18. So what the U.S. did was push for a very narrow prohibition that prohibits only forced recruitment for use in armed conflict. This language lets the U.S. off the hook. The problem is that it leaves the majority of child soldiers around the world unprotected, because most child soldiers could technically be called volunteers. They're lured into armed groups by promises of payment or food or protection. But to us, it doesn't make a difference how they're recruited, because the hazards that they face remain the same. And so we're extremely disappointed with the position that the U.S. took and the extreme pressure that it exerted to get its way in the convention. I think what it shows is that the U.S. is willing to sacrifice strong protections for children in armed conflict to its recruitment convenience. Hmm.
Joe Becker is with Human Rights Watch. We're also joined by Charlie Kernaghan, who is head of organization in New York called National Labor Committee that deals with the issue of labor. President Clinton, in his speech, said, "We must wipe from the earth the most vicious forms of abusive child labor. Every single day, tens of millions of children work in conditions that shock the conscience." Can you talk from your perspective, dealing with sweatshops around the world, where the U.S. has stood?
Well, in some ways, we have to congratulate and support any effort, obviously, to end bonded child labor and slavery and trafficking of children and drugs and prostitution. But if you put it in a larger context, the United States has refused to sign the Freedom of Association Convention, refused to sign the Collective Bargaining Convention, refused to sign the Minimum Working Age Convention, refused to sign the Elimination of Discrimination and Equal Pay Convention. In fact, Jesse Helms was trying to take the U.S. out of the International Labor Organization. One of the most interesting comments on this recent convention on the elimination of these worst forms of abuse was by India, where they said that child labor is not only a social problem, it's an economic problem, and we need to look at the parents, and we need to look at jobs and decent wages. And this is exactly where the larger picture of the global economy comes in, and the role of the U.S. companies and the role of the American people, because what we see around the world are the multinational companies locking very young women, 16, 17 years of age, in factories for 15-hour shifts at starvation wages, workers who are completely stripped of their rights, can be fired for even discussing factory conditions, and they're paid starvation below subsistence wages. So if we look at this in the overall context, I don't think it's going to create an enormous change.
The International Convention on the Rights of the Child, let me put this question to Joe Becker. Has it been signed off on by the United States?
The United States did sign the convention several years ago, but it has not been ratified by the U.S. The Convention on the Rights of the Child is the most broadly ratified human rights treaty in the world. There are 191 states parties. Every country has ratified with only two exceptions: Somalia, which actually has no organized government, and the United States. when I talk to representatives of other governments around the world, they have a really hard time understanding why a country like the United States that says it's serious about human rights and cares about the protections of children, why the U.S. can't ratify this very basic document.
And what is the rationale the U.S. uses?
It's opposition certainly is not from the Clinton administration. It comes from two primary sectors. One is conservative members of Congress like Jesse Helms, who are skeptical or resistant to any international treaty, believing that it will undermine U.S. sovereignty. The other segment, though, is members of the religious right in this country, and particularly groups like the Christian Coalition and others who basically have portrayed the Convention on the Rights of the Child as a threat to the American family. They believe that to recognize the rights of children is to undermine the rights of parents. I think anyone who's read the convention would reject that argument, but unfortunately they've managed to exert a lot of pressure on members of Congress.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Joe Becker, Children's Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. The website of Human Rights Watch is www.hrw.org. And Charlie Kernaghan, head of the National Labor Committee, based in New York City. Charlie, do you have a website?
Yes, actually, I'll give you the phone number. It's 212-242-3002.
That's 212-242-3002. Thank you very much for being with us. When we come back, we'll take a look at the Y2K bug with a man who knows, the man who invented the escape key and feels that this country could have escaped from what we face in the year 2000 if it hadn't been for the Pentagon and for Richard Nixon denying the problem when he raised it with them. We'll be speaking with Bob Beamer. Stay with us.
I trust dreams, I trust reality, but not the virtual kind. What I am is an analog girl, heart and soul and mind. No email, no cell phone, no computer, no microwave oven, just a doorbell, mailbox, voice, a guitar, a 24-hour lover. Analog girl in a digital world. The truth is not the facts, the world is not the maps, and every day the concrete cracks as the new grass unfurls like an
Analog Girl in a Digital World by Judy Gorman. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate approved legislation this week that would limit lawsuits against companies arising from the year 2000 computer problems. The bill would place a ceiling on punitive damages against corporations and give companies 90 days to solve their Y2K problems before they could be held liable. The Office of Management and Budget also raised to $8 billion its estimate of how much the federal government expects to spend fixing the Y2K bug. Also this week, a House subcommittee concluded that the U.S. public cannot be assured of receiving vital government services after the first of the year. The report concludes that only 2 of 43 essential government programs are fully Y2K compliant. Among those programs not in compliance are the air traffic control system and the massive health and human services payment system. Y2K arises from computers that may confuse the year 2000 for 1900 when the millennium hits. This may happen because some older software was designed to recognize only the last two digits. That's 00. Well, I think it would be better that our guest describes the problem rather than me, since he is a real pioneer in the age of computers, has been a programmer and much more for the last 50 years. His name is Bob Beamer. He's the inventor of the escape key. of ASCII computer code, as well as one of those involved in the original development of the COBOL language, which is the basic language of computers. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!, Bob Beamer.
Good morning.
Well, can you first tell us how it is that you realized that there was going to be a problem and when you realized it?
Well, it was about 1958. I was detailed to help the Mormon Church with their computerization of their genealogical database. And they had people in the database that were going back to, say, 800 A.D., and then up to 1112, and I realized at that time it really hit me that you had to store four digits away to know what year it was. And that struck me enough so that when COBOL came along, or even before that, I developed something called a picture clause, which is where you describe the data. And if people had used that correctly, among other things, we would never have been in this position today.
When you realized what could happen, what did you do about it?
Well, I didn't do much about it then until the international standard came out for writing the date in 1971. And what they were trying to do was fix the problem of the United States writing month, day, year, with a comma in there, and the Europeans and our own armed forces writing day, month, year. And I particularly got in that because I was detained in Geneva because they said my smallpox vaccination has expired. They wanted to quarantine me. And I explained, oh, the United States does it backwards. And I explained it to them. They let me go. And I said, we can't have this much anymore. So I started to support the international standard way of writing the date, which is year, month, day, just like you say the hour and then the minute when you read the time on your clock. And they were very specific about it to say that you better use four digits. And they were wise, but nobody paid much attention.
So you developed a program within COBOL, the basic business language of computers, to use four digits instead of two?
COBOL has always had that capability since year one. And I get very, very irked at people saying, oh, it's the fault of COBOL. It's not the fault of COBOL. It's not the fault of the English language, and it's not the fault of the COBOL language. It's the way people use the language.
By the way, COBOL stands for Common Business Oriented Language, and it is a basic standard programming language. As I read all the articles that have been written about you, Bob Beamer, over the last few months, or some of them, Time Magazine, Baltimore Sun had a very interesting piece, Vanity Fair. Along with you is the story of a very interesting woman. And I had not heard her name before, but she is well known in computer circles, really one of the pioneers in computers. Her name is Grace Hopper, and she was the first Navy Admiral, and didn't she also coin the term computer bug?
Yes, she did. That was the very early days of computers. They found a moth that was fouling up the computer operation.
She found it in her computer?
It was actually a moth in one of those old-fashioned circuit boards.
And so she called it a computer bug.
That's right. And since that day, every fault in a computer that a program makes an error, that's called a bug.
Well, the Y2K bug, to say the least, is an extremely serious issue. Now, you worked for IBM. You worked for the RAND Corporation. You brought your concerns to the Pentagon. When and what did they say?
Well, that's the problem. They didn't say anything. I talked, and they listened, and they wouldn't answer. I don't know how to figure it out.
What did you tell them?
I told them they're going to get in deep trouble. I even went to the Assistant Postmaster General in 1971 and said, how about let's putting the cancellation mark on the envelope so it reads with a four-digit year so people will get used to it. And they didn't worry about it.
Now, wasn't the rationale of the government that they had limited memory and they didn't want to use four digits because it takes up too much memory?
That is a specious
argument. It's only in the input it takes it up. You don't have to store it that way.
Why not?
Because there are other ways to do it. The point is that your local memory is expensive, right in the machine, or at least it was then. But at that time, we were using magnetic tape to store data, and it was cheap as could be. So the only place it took up expensive memory was as you moved it from the human through the machine onto the magnetic tape storage. So it was only in the machine that it was expensive. And that was a very small portion of the argument. All these things you hear now, oh, it was punch cards, no room on punch cards. Oh, all that memory was taped. Those are excuses from people that didn't do the right thing. And they told the reporters. And, of course, the reporters told it to other reporters who told it to still other reporters. So now it's a universally agreed truth.
You brought your concern to the Pentagon. They didn't respond. What about President Nixon?
Well, I tried to get a national computer year going in 1970 because I knew that computers were overtaking us like an express train. And even though all the usage then was sort of advisory, you'd look at the computer output and say, maybe I ought to do this. We were getting to the point where the computer actually acted, pulled the levers, switched the trains, made the diagnosis in hospitals, and everything. And all we people sat back and said, oh, isn't the computer wonderful making all these decisions for us? Except we said, never thought, well, suppose they're the wrong decisions. And now you find that one of the most dangerous areas as they come into this year 2000 is the hospitals. They're way behind. And that's where you don't want to have accidents happen.
We've been reading a lot about the possibilities of what could happen. I mean, the good news, as Vanity Fair pointed out, is that all senior citizens may get letters that they are negative 23 years old. The bad news is they won't be getting their Social Security checks. You'll have the situation, of course, just reading the latest of what the government has determined. For example, air traffic control is not Y2K compliant, which is a very frightening prospect for many. Nuclear power plants, nuclear weapon systems. You look at Russia and all of its nuclear weapons. It has hardly enough money to maintain its economy right now. What will happen? I mean, is anything being done to make their equipment and their bombs Y2K compliant? There's even discussion of having U.S. military people in the bomb sites of Russia so that they will be there at the time to determine if any kind of accident is about to happen.
Well, arrangement with Russia to sort of cross-monitor the various nuclear controls so that Y2K wouldn't shoot off anything accidentally. But Russia's not very happy with us now. And I don't know whether they're going to cooperate in that or not.
What is the scenario you paint for the year 2000? What's so interesting about your warning is it's not like a warning, for example, that a nuclear power plant could melt down, which could be some speculation, and it might happen and it might not. In this case, it clearly was going to happen, whether you look at it 50 years ago or now. Clearly, there was going to be a problem in the year 2000 when you just have 00 in the computer instead of 2000.
I'm glad you say that. Clearly, there was. But just as clearly, nobody else saw that so clearly.
Is it that because we're run by a country of politicians and that they have term limits? Basically, they're not concerned about what will happen in 20 years or 30 years?
Not only the politicians, it's the business people. You go to the Harvard Business School and they say, only worry about the bottom line for the next 6 months because by that time it's somewhere else and your successor will have to worry about your mistakes. We should be a lot more ethical in business of saying, well, if I make a mistake and hurt the people of the country, I better try to stay and solve it, help it out.
We're talking.
It's been swept under the rug.
We're talking to Bob Beamer, who is the inventor of the escape key. Is there some kind of escape we can all make on December 31st, just as where the clock strikes midnight?
I wish there were.
Well,
I mean, of course, the government and person of John Koskinen tells us it's going to be like a three-day snowstorm. They'll be all over with.
Well, interestingly enough, President Clinton had proposed that we move New Year's to January 3rd so that there could be more time to for people to fix the Y2K problem. But really specifically, what do you see happening? And can bombs be launched by themselves?
This mistake is 30 years old at least. You can't fix it in 2 days. Furthermore, it's not all going to happen on January 1st. That's ridiculous. Things will happen that you will see. Obvious failures. And you could look at it and say, oh, I better hurry up and fix that, and I can find out why, and they will get fixed. It's the non-obvious things that are going to kill us. The things that don't look like they've broken, but they have.
Like?
If your bank account gets fouled up, and we have evidence and actual cases of this, the people don't know that till 3 months later, till they say, hey, something's wrong here. And the data may never turn up to a year after the year 2000, and it'll be all wrong. I know a case where the Air Force was working on a computer, and they had 3 years of wrong answers and didn't know the answers were wrong. That's my fear.
What can everyday people do now?
Pardon?
What can everyday people do now to deal with the Y2K bug?
I would go to my representative, congressman, senator, and say, you have come out saying that you support the government's principle that there's no problem. Now, if there isn't any problem, I want you to know that I will never vote for you again. Do you know, but that might work. Do you know what the first program gets fixed when a company finds out there's a Y2K problem?
Which one?
The pension program. So that management is going to get theirs no matter what else happens. Now, I can't default self-interest, but it's certainly a strange coincidence that's the first one they fix.
You think prison gates around the country will just open on midnight of December 31st, 1999?
No, I do not. I think there will be some glitches. I think we might get some in the next 2 weeks when most of the states change over to a new fiscal year. I think that we're going to feel the effects of this at least as far as 2003. And once you corrupt data, you know, a commercial installation, a big company, always makes backup on tape or disk of all its data. So in case the program crashes tomorrow, they can reconstruct it. But now we have viruses, and you hear all these reports in the press, and these people say, we're wiped out, we lost all our data. And they said, didn't you back it up? Gee, no, we forgot. And so if you don't back up your data and you do 6 months of work on your PC, and you find out it's wrong, how are you going to reconstruct it so you can go back and start over again?
Well, Bob Beamer, I want to thank you for being with us and for being there over these years, giving us the ominous warning that is clearly taking place today, talking about the Y2K bug. And you're saying that it's something that we have to deal with right now because there are computer companies that are there are systems that are switching over as we move into a new fiscal year. Last question. We just have 10 seconds. What about nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons?
Just saw something on that this morning. They have 2 weeks to decide whether they have to shut them down or not because it takes 6 months to cool. And to cool them, you have to have water. And if your nuclear plant may be okay, but something else might happen, you have to make sure your water systems are working.
Well, that does it for today's discussion, but we do hope to have you back soon. Bob Beamer, a computer programmer who invented the escape key, ASCII, and was involved with the original program, COBOL. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director, Michael Eade, our headlines editor. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
As the new grass unfurls like an analog.